formal mission of U Equals Me is stated as a movement of conscientious objectors to intolerance, or simply stated, a movement against intolerance. And the exploration of that statement really gets to what are the similarities between people? What do we all have in common? Why are we really equal as humankind? And that's what we're going to explore.
This podcast is about exploring conversational thoughts and interviews with extraordinary people living ordinary lives of well-being. Discussions on exactly what well-being means to people day to day, factors that can influence it both internally and externally. We glean insights on how to survive and thrive in feeling satisfied in life with a greater sense of purpose. Guest hosts bring fresh new outlooks and opinions from spirituality, science, worldviews, and standing up and speaking out for what's right.
It's pretty interesting. Man needs each other and planet Earth to survive. Check it out. I think you'll like what you hear.
All right, we did this. Welcome to our U Equals Me podcast.
Well, glad to be here.
Thank you, Gary. And we thank our friends and family from around the world for your support for the U Equals Me Foundation. U Equals Me bridges all cultures, races, religions, and genders with its message globally. My name is Cindy Jarvis, and I'm with my co-host today, Bruce Jarvis. And today we're going to chat with a dear friend and teammate of Bruce's, Gary Carr. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Welcome, old friend.
We finally got the audio figured out.
Okay. Well, like I said, unfortunately, I couldn't do it on my computer, but I got it on my cell phone.
Yeah, perfect.
We're up and running. That's the main thing.
We're up and running. It's so nice that you and Bruce have remained connected after all those years at the University of Washington.
Yes. Yes, we go back to this 1960. First time I met Bruce was in 1969. He was a tall, good-looking center for our football team. And I was a young, naive JC transfer up from Grays Harbor. I was just in awe to be there.
We should explain, because people will be listening to this all over, Gary.
Okay.
Grays Harbor is a community on the coast of the state of Washington, about 2.5 hours drive, maybe 3 hours drive from Seattle.
Mm-hmm. And the reason that I had to attend Grays Harbor Junior College was when I graduated from high school, I did not meet the academic requirements of the University of Washington. So they recommended that I go to a junior college. And the junior college that I decided to go to was Grays Harbor Junior College because I had friends that were going down there. Everything worked out.
I've asked Gary to come on today onto our podcast so that we could continue to share a conversation we were having last month about growing up Black in America and really understanding the challenges people face from hundreds of years of systemic racism. We believe we can help create a more inclusive sense of belonging by having these conversations in our workplace, neighborhoods, communities, and even in our own families. I think it's really important. Some of the systemic racism that I would like to address goes back forever. Redlining, mortgage lending discrimination, education. All these are examples of systemic racism, predatory loans. Even today, it's still happening today. It's harder for people of color to refinance their homes or buy a new one.
I'd say don't forget about the big guy in the room, the big subject in the room, healthcare.
Healthcare and education.
Well, you know, healthcare has always been a big issue in the Black community. When you look at it from a healthcare standpoint, from a Black man and a Black woman live basically 5 years less than a white man and a white woman. So that immediately tells you that there is a discrimination on the at towards the end of our life. And then you look at infant mortality. The infant mortality rate has always been higher among blacks than it has with whites.
That's
so,
right.
So when you start out in life from a healthcare standpoint, you know, you're starting out on the losing end. And after you live your life, you come out on the losing end because you're living 5 years less than the majority of white people if you're a black man or a black woman. So that just, like Bruce said, when you talk about healthcare, that's a major, major issue.
Right.
And
add in, Gary, the other major subject that should be a right for all Americans, and I believe everyone in the world, well, let's just stick with America, education. You take the steps backward in education, healthcare, subpar, it's a double whammy.
Mm-hmm.
And it also affects life, the amount of years you're going to live on this planet. Lack of education and healthcare.
Well, you know, and you're so true when you say that about education. Because as you know, Bruce, I've told you before that I have done some substitute teaching in the Seattle School District for 6 years of my life after I retired from working for Levi Strauss for 25 years. And the inner city schools, you know, at the time, Rainier Beach, Franklin, you actually graduated from Franklin High School, Bruce, as you know. But Franklin High School of now is completely different than Franklin High School when you graduated, what was it, back in 1966?
1966, and the reason for that, as you well know, is the demographic change.
That's exactly right.
Driven now, by what's termed as white flight.
That's right. That's right.
White people going to the suburbs.
And what's funny now is it seems like white flight has come back to the city, and the black people are moving out of the city.
Have been pushed out. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's basically it. They have been pushed out, and it's a whole different dynamic now in 2021 than it was in 1971 when I graduated from the University of Washington. Mm-hmm. And housing has always been a big problem in the black community, whereas, as you said, Cindy, redlining was a problem. Today, 70% of white people own their homes, whereas only 40% of black people own their home. And a lot of wealth is created because of your home.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the net worth of a lot of black people. The net worth on a national average for a black man and a black woman in their family, it's like $17,000. That's the average net worth of a black family. And then you look at the average net worth of a white family, which is, I believe, around $170,000, $180,000.
10 times that, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, that's a form of discrimination right there.
Mm-hmm.
And that just basically lets you know that black people, African American people, have not been playing on the same playing field over the last 72 years of my life.
Right.
And it's not as difficult today because of certain policies that the Democratic administrations have put in place over the years, but it's still difficult. A lot of African American people to get housing because of all the indirect ways that lending institutions can hurt Black people from getting the opportunity to buy a home. It's a really a tricky process.
And also employment. Black people are not paid what their white counterparts are paid. That's a known fact.
I believe that Black women especially are paid like 20 cents on the dollar less than white women. Mm-hmm. And it might be, I think it might be a little higher, 25% on the dollar for white men that are doing the same job.
The same job.
And that's very, very unfortunate when you look at how the country is made up today and the type of contributions that African American people are making in society.
Can I ask you to explain how your family has evolved, what their ages are, and just give a brief background and where they are now?
Well, to talk about my family as a whole, you know, my mother and father came to the Northwest in the 40s during World War II. My father came out here to work in the steel plants, and he thought that once he got out here, he'd work during the war, and then after the war, he was going to go back home and live in Georgia, where he was from. But once he got out here, he realized it was difficult for a Black man to be successful out here and to find a job. But he told me, he says, Gary, as difficult it was in the Northwest, it was 10 times that down south. So he decided to stay up here and live in the Northwest. And I was born in 1949, and I was one of nine children. And the thing that my father demanded from his kids was to work hard and try to get a good education.
And if I may interject, you grew up about 30 miles south of Seattle in the city of Tacoma, which, although we're close geographically, is quite different in terms of the type of workforce, what drives the economic engine of Tacoma versus Seattle. Even when you're growing up, it was a blue-collar city, very industrial, with a large military presence because of Fort Lewis and the Air Force Base nearby.
Right. Well, see, and Blacks did not have any opportunities during that time period. Because, for example, for myself, I used to see my father. He would come home working. He worked for a company called Ohio Ferrol, and he was an oiler. And what I mean by, he said he was an oiler, he would oil all the machinery to make sure everything was running smoothly.
And that's at a manufacturing plant?
Right, in Tacoma. And he says he worked there for 30 years, Bruce, Cindy. And during that 30-year time period, he had the same job for 30 years. He told me he could do that job blindfolded. And he said that he never could get promoted, because at that time, he says, they did not allow Black men to be a foreman, which would be the next grade up. And a foreman would supervise all the other oilers that were in the plant.
And probably make 50% more in compensation.
But the unique thing about that, Bruce and Cindy, was my father told me he trained seven of his bosses. He would train them to supervise him.
Yeah.
And
if that isn't racism flat out, I don't know what is.
And I would ask him, I'd say, Father, why did you put up with that? He says, Son, when you have 9 kids and you don't have any other opportunities, you know, you have to do what you have to do. So it was, and me personally, I didn't realize what he was talking about until I got into high school. And I used to work on a farm. I started out on this farm when I was in the 9th grade. And, I was getting paid 75 cents an hour. And then.
What are you doing, Gary?
Oh, I worked on a bean farm, and, we would string beans. We would, irrigate beans, a big bean field, big, massive acres and acres of bean fields.
Backbreaking work.
And I used to work 7 days a week, 10 hours a day minimum. And after a couple of years, you know, I found out that the employer that I was working for was paying my white counterparts 25 cents more than they were paying me. And the thing that was really ironic about that was that I had been on the job for 2 years, and the new guys that he had hired, they hadn't even worked there, but he was paying them. I had gotten a raise. He was paying them $1.25, and I was paid $1. And I asked him, I says, his name was Lyle Rader. I says, Lyle, how come these guys are making 25 cents an hour more than me? And I've been here for 2 years and they've never worked for you. And he just told me, he says, well, Gary, you can work 2 hours extra every day to catch up with them.
And what he really meant was their skin is white.
And that to me, that's when I understood, white privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always told my white friends about white privilege, and they say, I haven't been privileged in any way whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And then I try to break it down to them in a simple way. And I agree. And I say, you know, white privilege doesn't mean that white people haven't worked hard for what they have. Bruce, you've worked hard for what you've had. And it also doesn't mean that white people haven't, suffered.
Right.
Doing what they have, doing what they have done to get what they have. It simply means that they have never been denied anything simply because they're white.
Simply because they're white. And this, you know, Gary, I'd like to ask you how we can even talk about race, because I've heard this myself many times. I've heard people say, well, I don't see color, to try and express that they're not prejudiced. But this is really problematic to diversity and inclusion efforts, because if you can't see anything, if you can't see color, then we can't change anything. And everybody sees color. Children see color, especially. And no matter, you know, what our color, we all have preconceived notions and expectations about different racial groups. We do. And we think recognition and acknowledgement are crucial. And white people have a very difficult time recognizing that.
Well, you know, the thing I've got many, many white friends. Bruce and Cindy, you are two prime examples. And I always say it's not enough to be non-racist. You have to be anti-racist.
Exactly.
You have to be advocate against racism. You have to be when you're in a situation as a white man, as a white woman, and you see racism up front, you have to be there to confront it and say, no, 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 no.
Absolutely.
Right. And if you're not an advocate for racism, you're still part of the problem.
Right.
It's kind of like Donald Trump. I like to use the 45th president as an example. I hear people all the time, they say that they're not racist, but they voted for Donald Trump.
Yes.
And prior to that, they tell me that he has no redeeming quality that they admire about. So, and I try to tell him, I said, if you don't say that Donald Trump is what he is and what you see that's right in front of you based on how he's conducting himself, don't tell me you're an advocate against racism, because right. He is the biggest racist that he is in my lifetime. He is without a doubt the biggest racist we've had as a president.
Without a doubt. And when we first started U Equals Me, we knew America was politely racist. The white silence and the blindness of white supremacy. Within the last 5 years, you know, during our last political presidency, racism, it's no longer polite. And we are in grave danger if we don't demand that all people be treated with honor. It's white people now who are responsible for what happens now. I couldn't agree with you more. It's time for white people to do the racial justice work.
Just briefly, Gary, and I wanted you also talk about your kids, where they are, just briefly, each one of them, there's a reason why I want you to sketch that out.
Well, both my kids graduated. First of all, my wife and I, when we were raising our kid, being that, you know, I'm a University of Washington graduate, and my wife is a University of Maryland graduate, you know, we were big on education. And we knew the importance of getting a quality education. So we wanted to make sure our kids got a quality education.
And could you just briefly just give the audience Sita's background racially?
Well, you know, Sita grew up in Washington, D.C. Then when she was like in the fifth or sixth grade, she moved to the suburbs of Clinton, Maryland, which is probably 10 miles out. It's kind of like Bellevue is to Seattle. Clinton, Maryland is like 10 miles outside of Washington, D.C. And her mother and father were poor, just like my mother and father.
What is their racial makeup?
Sita's father, her grandfather on her mother's side was Filipino. And her mother was black. There was a lot of diversity
right.
on both sides of her family. And being in that Washington D.C. area, and then moving to Clinton, Maryland, they faced more than their share of racism when they were growing up, because the fact that you know, they were light skinned. It was difficult for her and her family when she was growing up. Okay. But getting back to my two kids, Garrison, he was a good athlete in high school. He played basketball. He got a basketball scholarship to American University, by the way, which is in Washington, D.C. And one of the reasons he chose American University was because that is where his mother grew up, and there were relatives back there that would give him support during his 4 years back there. And currently, Garrison is living in New York City, and he works for Amazon right there in Manhattan in their AWS division, which is responsible for the cloud, and that is the most lucrative division within the Amazon Corporation, and he has billion-dollar accounts that he represents for Amazon. So I'm extremely proud of him. Now, my daughter, Johanna, she graduated from the University of Washington, and she went to the University of Washington on a track scholarship. And she graduated early. She did University of Washington in like 3.5 years. And she graduated early. And she currently, over the last 5 years, she's been working for Google as a executive recruiter for Google. And she's doing quite well for herself. So Sita and myself are really proud of our two kids.
So you absolutely have every reason to be prideful father and mom. Now, how did your kids get to where they are, really so different from the average Black person in America?
The first thing is they have a mother and father, and they had a mother and father who deeply loved them, you know, just like Cindy and Bruce deeply loved their son, Freddie. And we both, Sita and I both came from large families. My family, there was 9 brothers and sisters. Sita's family, there were 8 brothers and sisters. And Sita was in the middle, and I was in the middle. So we got zero attention from our mothers and father when we was growing up. And we got zero attention, not because our mother and father didn't love us, because there was always a baby to take care of, and there was always food that needed to be put on the table. So Sita's mother and father were almost identical to my mother and father, and they used to rule the house with an iron fist. And I mean that literally. I mean, my father was, he says, there is no democracy in my household. He said, this is a dictatorship. And when I look back at it, you know, I'm glad it was like that because, you know, I grew up in a rough neighborhood. We grew up in the housing projects in Tacoma. And if my father wouldn't have been there to crack down on me, there is a 100% chance that, you know, I would be here talking to you today and even knowing you, Bruce. But the fact that he kept me out of trouble, you know, I have the utmost respect for him. But when I was growing up, you know, I had a very difficult time dealing with my father because, you know, he was such a determined man in how he dealt with us. But I really got to know him. He was 70 years old when I really had what I would say is a father-son relationship. Because the first 70 years of his life, I had a difficult time, you know, just talking to my father. But the last 15 years of his life, he passed away when he was 85. You know, I was happy. I'm happy to say that my father and I had a great relationship.
And one of the things that you have told me that sticks out about you and your dad, some of the things that he imparted, the wisdom that he imparted to you. And one phrase I will never forget, because you told me, he said to you, Gary, I'll take right and beat you every time.
See, and that was one of his favorite saying. And he said, Gary, right sometimes works extremely slow. But if you're doing the right thing, you're going to win in the long run. You know, and I kind of get kind of tied up emotionally when I talk about my father, because he had such a hard life. he didn't really tell me about how difficult his life was until, you know, I was in my 40s and 50s before he passed away. Because his father passed away when he was 13 years old. And he had his mother and four sisters to take care of. And he used to tell me about how bad he was treated down south when he was a young man. And the thing that I admired about him was, he said, son, when you were growing up, I didn't want to talk about things like that because he didn't think I was mature enough to handle it. Because, you know, he used to get beat up when he was in the South by white men. He says the policeman one time put a gun to his head and they told him he was going to, they were going to kill him if he was lying to him. And I mean, there was just story after story of all the difficult things that he had to deal with that I didn't have to deal with. And I've had to deal with quite a bit myself in my life.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a long, there's so many incidents that I could talk about that it happened to my father and to me personally.
Right.
Because we don't have enough time on this podcast. Right?
I know. So, I know.
So how do we change that, Gary? We're 150 years past the Civil War.
Right.
Emancipation fell apart. Jim Crow came to the South. Fast forward to today, we've had the most reactionary leader that this country probably ever had. I think that's easy to say. How do we change it? How do white people, black people, Asian people, Native Americans, how do they learn about one another in a meaningful way, not in the way where you have a 3-hour class on racial understanding and then go home and forget everything that you heard a half an hour ago? How do we affect meaningful change?
Well, you know, it's kind of like when you're having a conversation about race, it's just like, Bruce, the conversations I've had with you about race. You know, it's about respect. It's about showing people that you respect of what they're talking about and be prepared to listen and don't be overreacting about certain things. Cause you know, a lot of times when people start talking about race, they automatically throw their hands up and they become defensive.
Very.
You know, and both sides have to do that because, when I talk to people, when I've talked to my white friends over the years, you know, I always ask them what happened, particularly in their life, that makes them feel the way they feel. And a lot of times the majority of them, you know, they have formed their opinion based on one or two experiences, negative experiences that they've had about black people. And as a black man, race and racism has always been the giant elephant in the room.
Yes.
With all people of color. And until we are prepared to listen and understand. It's just, it's like the George Floyd situation.
Yes. Yeah. Until people first start to understand the impact and the deceptions of our own whiteness, nothing changes.
I mean, it's like I said, I was going to use the George Floyd, you know, people wouldn't believe that the police would do something like that if it wasn't on video.
That's right.
They wouldn't believe it. It's like people, and I've told this to Bruce, I have been victimized, brutalized by police before. Mm-hmm. I have twice in my life, I have had policemen put guns to my head and threaten to kill me for no reason at all. Once when I was in Sacramento, a policeman put a gun to my head and he pulled me over and he got me out of the car and he frisked me and he said I was selling drugs. And I've never sold drugs. I've never done. The only drugs I've ever taken in my life is aspirin or prescription drug for my high blood pressure. Those are the only drugs that I've had. But he threatened. He says I was a drug dealer. And the same thing happened to me in San Francisco. I had a policeman put a gun to my head.
This is when you're working for Levi.
This is when I was working for Levi Strauss. And my point is, when I tell people that, I mean, they're shocked because they know me. They know that I'm not the type of person that's out there, you know,
causing trouble.
But
you were a sales executive for Levi Strauss.
I thought you were going to call him a saint.
Well, he is kind of a saint.
But see, it's like, Bruce, see, you know me, Cindy, you know me, but if you don't know a black person, you know, black people never get the benefit of the doubt. See, mm-hmm. And I'm saying that from being 72 years old. In my lifetime, I have never, ever gotten the benefit of the doubt.
Derek, question. I recently heard on one of the cable news channels a sociologist speaking on the subject of how do we increase and affect true racial understanding as a stepping stone to diversity. And in short order, the way I would distill what he said was we have to live together. And where do we live together? That was the question of the host. And he says, well, right now, where we live together in certain places and is in school, right? You're living together 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, 9 months a year, and in the workplace, okay? And certain workplaces with more diverse workforces. And then lastly, the question was put, are there studies? And he said, there have been studies. They've been done in homogeneous communities, where statistically there have been people living in neighborhoods that were diverse, et cetera, versus all white or all black. And then there have been data analysis done of that. And the short answer is that that's really the way for lasting change to occur.
You know, that's part of it. But you know something, Bruce, Cindy, when I look at today's society, you know, I see the new generation, your son's generation, my sons and daughters' generation, they're making progress. It's better. I can honestly say it's a lot better in 2021 than it was in 1971. See, when I was growing up and I grew up around poor white people, as well as poor black people. We were all living in the projects. So we all had one thing in common. We were all poor. We were black and we were white. And in my first, it's like even Bruce. When Bruce and I play football at the University of Washington, even though we were teammates, I bet you, and correct me if I'm wrong, Bruce, you and me in my 2.5 years at the University of Washington never spent 30 minutes talking to each other.
That's right. That's right.
See, why? Because I had this personal visualization of how white people were based on how I'd been treated for the first, 21 years of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in a society where everyone was telling me what I couldn't do.
Right.
Nobody ever told me what I could do. See, and I think I told Bruce once before, when I was a kid growing up, I wanted to be a milkman. Think about it. I wanted to be, I'm 10, 4, 5th, 6th grader, because I see a guy driving around the neighborhood delivering milk in a nice uniform.
Yeah, usually happy too. He's usually a happy guy.
Yeah. And I said to myself, that's what I can do that. And why did I have that idea in my mind? Because I never saw a black man, let alone a black woman, in any responsible position as a kid growing up. You know, there were no black teachers. There were no black policemen, no lawyers.
No black doctors, vice president.
Nothing. There were no black people in any position of power. Even in sports, when I played football, if you were black, you couldn't play quarterback. You couldn't be the middle linebacker. They were always telling you what you couldn't do.
Right.
And if you hear that for the first 21 years of your life, it really affects you.
It does. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges that we all face personally, not just being black or just being poor, or I think what we face as a humanity is the challenge of not believing what others, the limits that others have put upon you.
Well, see, and today, this generation, my son's generation, Freddie's generation, your son, my daughter, they are growing up seeing African American people making a major contribution to society.
Mm-hmm.
In every aspect of life.
Yes.
That's a good point.
That is a good point.
And it throws away the old myth that black people haven't made any contribution to this country. Because when I was growing up, I thought Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, and that was it.
And racism was over.
And we made no contribution to society. And if you think about it, if you look back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, if you turned on the TV, you would never see black people, period. If you were from another country, you would think that black people don't live in America because they weren't representative in any way whatsoever in American society. And when they were representative, it was always in a negative light. See, so the mindset that a lot of black people have is that, hey, the only way that we can make it in my era was if you played sports. Or if you could sing or dance. But today, in Freddie's and Garrison and Johanna's environment, they see people of all colors, not only black, Hispanic, Asian. making a contribution to this country. And so when the ex-president used to say he's going to make America great again, I always asked, who is he talking about? Because when you look over the last 50 years, how great America has become, it's because of all the diversity.
Absolutely.
Increasing diversity.
That's right. From all of our people, women, white women, black women, Asian women, Hispanic women, black men, Hispanic men. I mean, everybody, gay people.
Exactly.
I mean, it's a multicultural society where everybody is making a contribution. Mm-hmm. Whereas Bruce and you will attest to this. When you and me were growing up, everything was 100% all white men in every possible position of leadership and power. And I always think about when I was a kid, I always used to think about the Pledge of Allegiance of the flag. Every day we would stand up from first grade through sixth grade and we would say, I pledge allegiance to the United States of America. And, you know, whatever it said, for one nation under God, individual with liberty. But the last three words always threw me off. And the last three words were justice for all.
Liberty and justice for all.
That's right. Liberty and justice for all. And I used to say to myself as I got older, I says, black people, we can't get any justice, you know? And then you look at when I say that, Bruce, Cindy, it gets back to what you were saying earlier in the podcast, Cindy, when you were talking about systemic racism. When you look at black men are 6% of the population. But in terms of being incarcerated, 32% of all men that are incarcerated are black men. I mean, how is that possible that we can be 6% of the population, but 32% of the people that are incarcerated?
I'm a student of statistics, and it can't happen without systemic racism.
That's exactly right. And that's why, you know, African-American people of today, you know, we're fighting to change the dynamics, and we have to stand up for what's right and the progress that we've made, because we can't turn the clock back. When you see the voter suppression laws that they're trying to implement across the country, I mean, when you see the people on the right just doing everything that they can in their power to undermine democracy, I mean, all people have to stand up. And one of the things that, Cindy, that I love about your husband is this. He is, I call him a freedom fighter. When I talk to Sita, I says, I talked to the freedom fighter today. When he used to come to the gym on a regular basis, I've had some of the best conversations about social justices that I've ever had just talking to him.
Mm-hmm. Let me interject here, because we read something here a couple days ago about one of the newest and, in my opinion, most effective philanthropists in the world, and that's Jeff Bezos' ex-wife.
Oh yeah, I heard.
Escapes me.
$50 million.
Mackenzie.
Yeah, that's right.
Mackenzie Scott, sorry, I believe.
Apologies mm-hmm. to that great woman.
Yeah.
But she's given $50 million to Prairie View A&M. She's also donating hundreds of millions of dollars to historic black colleges all across America and other great causes. But she said something in this article that it really sticks with me, and that is that those organizations that are really contributing to the advancement of society today, most of them are this is me paraphrasing, most of them are deriving great ideas, and the greatest font of those ideas comes from one main thing. That's hearing many voices from many backgrounds. Diversity is a great progenitor of original thought. And original thought, when it comes right down to it, is the most valuable thought, because those are the inventors. Those are the new things that come and bring society forward. So this idea that we stick to our own, we're white people, we're black people, we're Native Americans, etc. No, it doesn't add to the mix. It subtracts from the mix. And to add to and help solve the problems of America, we need diversity.
Diversity is a well-stocked kitchen. Some people will say, well, I have to get rid of this Tabasco. I don't want Tabasco in my apple pie. Well, if you don't put it in your apple pie, you're not going to get it in your apple pie. So we need to really talk about the truth here. We need to get rid of politicians that want to continue not telling the truth. We need to vote for people in power that support diversity. And this is what we're going to do. And we're going to do that by sharing this podcast today.
Hey, well, you're so correct. And diversity is the key. I mean, when my kids, I just look at my kids, because I always like to use my kids as an example, because they're millennials. They're knee deep in it right now. And my daughter just recently got married, and I looked at her bridesmaids. She had a black bridesmaid. She had an Asian bridesmaid. She had an Hispanic bridesmaid, and she had a white bridesmaid.
She did. I saw the pictures.
And I said to myself, I looked at Cedar, I says, and now that's diversity. Mm-hmm. I mean, and then I looked at my, the groomsman, her husband, who comes from a diverse background, because his mother is white, his father's black, and his bride's, his groomsmen he had two black guys and two white guys. And when I was driving home, I was talking to my wife from the wedding, and I says, and just looking at the people at the wedding, I mean, it was diversity at the highest level, and it really made me feel good as a father, and my wife as a mother, to see that our kids are getting it. And when they say make America great, I think of that generation truly has an opportunity to make America greater than it already is.
Mm-hmm. By including rather than excluding.
Mm-hmm. Diversity is our power.
That's so true. And when I see, like I said earlier, when I see these women on TV, especially the black women on TV, and one thing that my father instilled in me long time ago, he said, Gary, even in the 60s, when things were really difficult, and Bruce, I look at you and Cindy kind of this way. He says, Gary, even though there's a lot of evil white people out there, you still have a lot of great white people out there. He says, there's always been white people that have stepped up and helped him along the way. And I look at my life. I look at my own life. I've always had wipe of friends step up and help me along the way. So when we see and hear all that negativity on TV and we read about it in the newspaper and see it over the internet, I always tell people this. There's still even though 75 million people voted for Donald Trump, there was 85 million people that didn't vote for Donald Trump. So the majority of people in this country get it.
Right.
We just have to keep working on the parts of America that don't get it.
Right.
And make sure that they get on board instead of trying to perpetuate the same unrest and BS that we've been seeing.
Mm-hmm. Because hatred is not the opposite of love. Fear is. And why would you want to be such a weak person?
There's a lot of weak people on the right. And I used to tell this to Bruce all the time when he used to go to the gym. I was just absolutely amazed that how many Republican leaders were afraid to step up and talk about the truth based mm-hmm. on what was happening. Because right. prior to that, all I used to hear them was talk about was the Constitution this, the Constitution that. But when the Constitution was under fire, none of them stepped up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Republican Party is
Howard.
The party of exclusion currently. And until they become a party of inclusion, they will continue to decline. And they are in the process, I believe, and I certainly hope, of figuring that out the very hard way.
In the meantime, Gary, Bruce, we the people.
Amen.
That's right.
I thank you guys so much for your time today. It's so quickly how time passes when you're having fun. And Gary, Bruce, thank you guys so much for your time. I'm really looking forward to sharing this. Ideas, when they're shared, it increases and it's helpful for everybody.
I'm just glad that you invited me. And I've never done anything like this before. And actually, once you get into it, you know, I got started, I was kind of nervous. But once, you know, having you two guys walking me through the process, it's just been helpful. And I really enjoyed myself.
Oh, that's wonderful. We'll do it again.
Well, Gary, you and Robert Redford are the natural.
No, there's only one Robert Redford. I mean, it's as far as he's to me, you know, he's not Robert Redford. He's always going to be Butch Cassidy to me. Yeah.
There's a man that understands inclusion and diversity.
That's right.
Yes.
Just like I said, it's, and one last thing, it's kind of like, and I've told, and my father told me this, and I understand a lot better today than at the time when he was telling me. He said, Gary, he says, let me tell you something. He says, when you hear a black person talking about a white man is not this, white man is not that, asked him this question. He says, who have made your life difficult? You've had black people that made your life difficult probably more than white people have overall. And the same with a white person. He would say, son, you asked a white person who has made their life more difficult, a white person or a black person? And they will say, a white person.
Mm-hmm. Same question.
Because they know more white people, just mm-hmm. like black people know more black people. So he says everything gets down to the individual. He says there's good black people and there's bad black people. There's good white people and there's bad white people. There's good Asians and bad Asians. See, there's good and bad in everybody.
There's bad people.
That's right. He says just look, you know, always try to look for the positive in people.
Oh, that's great.
And my father, like I said, the most that he ever made on a job, the most, was $3.25 an hour.
Wow.
That's the most he ever made on a job.
Yeah.
And just like Bruce said, he was right. He says, son, do the right thing. And he says, I'll take right and I'll beat you every time. And he says, right. He says, right, son, sometimes it works slow, but if you're doing the right thing, you're going to win. And
he's right.
And I can say now that I'm 72 years old, I thoroughly understand what he was talking about.
Yep. Well, thank you guys so much for your time. I really appreciate it and look forward to chatting again.
Okay. Sounds like a winner.
We are so grateful Gary agreed to share a conversation with you. It is important to tell the truth about America now and in our history in the treatment of our Black brothers and sisters. And the truth is the enslaved built America with their bare hands, but we will rebuild the United States of America with our hearts. America's strength is due to its diversity, and we will continue to push on until the words one nation, indivisible, liberty, and justice for all. In other words, you equals me. I have included in the show notes some recommended reading by Seattle author Ijeoma Oluo. So You Want to Talk About Race, that's the name of her book. And also How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi. Please support the U Equals Me Foundation at uequalsme.org. You can also support by the purchase of our logo wear, U Equals Me etsystore.com, all one word in your Google search. You can join our One Worlders group for a complimentary ebook, Wisdom Along the Way, a book of notes and quotes. Thanks again. Much love around the world.